So, good evening, everyone. Again, wonderful to see you all. Thank you for joining. Again, I would like to start with the motivations. And then talk about the topics of discussion for this weekend. Okay. Keep yourself comfortable. And feel the weight of your body on cushion or chair. And as you inhale and exhale naturally, normally. Keep your mind observing it mindfully. Thereby keeping your attention with the breath. Once your mind has settled down, then we can try to reflect and contemplate that as long as our mind is not free from self-centeredness and self-grasping ignorance, negative emotions such as attachments, anger, jealousy, pride, so forth will arise, will manifest in our mind. And whenever one of those negative emotions arises, it disturbs our peaceful mind. in that moment, there's no calmness, peacefulness. Instead, our mind gets restless, agitated, disturbed. And as long as our mind is agitated and disturbed in such a way, no matter what happens in our life situations, we will feel unhappy. Even when things are going well, still our mind feel dissatisfied, unhappy, disturbed. And that miserable mind does not go away by changing the place. By changing the job. By changing the partnership, partner. By changing the food, whatever we could change, but still we could be very unhappy, miserable, because one of those negative emotions has manifested, arises in our mind. Therefore, changing the external conditions does not change our experience, inner experience of being miserable, unhappy. No matter what you do, no matter where you go, you are still carrying that disturbed mind. That's making you unhappy, miserable. On the other hand, if we do not have or even less of self-centeredness, selfish, self-centeredness, self-grasping ignorance, there's less arising and manifesting those negative emotions. Less disturbed in our mind, less agitations. Less unhappiness, less miserable. And if we don't have arising of any of those delusions, negative emotions, then, you know, no matter what the external conditions are, good or bad. You can still keep your mind calm, peaceful. Joyful. Not only when you are in good health, even when you have not so great health. Not only when you have good relationship, even when you don't have the best relationship. Not only when you are doing financially well, when you are doing not so great, even in such situations, you can still find peaceful calmness and joyfulness. Therefore, whether we or our life become miserable or joyful, it mainly depends on our state of mind more than the external conditions. That being the case, if we want to have more peace, more joyful, more happy life, we need to pay more attention to our mind than the external conditions. We need to work with our mind more than external conditions. In order to reduce and eliminate those disturbing negative emotions, which are the source of our miserable unhappiness, pain. We need to contemplate, meditate, practice. Correctly, continuously. To do that, we need to be reminded of those practices, meditations, all the time. Therefore, I'm going to listen to the talk. Not only listen, but whatever we learn, we take in with us in our everyday life and try to apply as much as possible. And may all of us coming here together, giving our precious time, energy, resources to listen, to engage in discussion, reflecting, contemplating. May all of this become cause and conditions to obtain fully awakened state. So we can be a greatest help, benefit to oneself and to all sentient beings. Okay, we'll go to the refuge and bodhicitta, continue from previous one. I go for refuge under my enlightenment to the Buddha, the Dharma, and Supreme Insight. By the merit I pray to listen to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha and a benefit such as Sāṅgye ca dāṁ sōkye ca nāṁ bā caṁ ca pādhu dāṁ ca 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 dāṁ ca ca dī pē sō nāṁ te ca lā pēn ca sāṅgye ca bā sō Sāṅgye ca dāṁ sōkye ca nāṁ bā caṁ ca pādhu dāṁ ca 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 So, as you all are aware, the topic of the discussions during this weekend will be Dhammakatha Sutra. On that, in this sutras, Dhammakatha Sutras, is one of the most well-known. And recited and studied in all the Mahayana traditions. It's very common in Tibetan traditions, in all lineage. This was actually one of the first sutra I was introduced when I was very young. In our village, you know, people invite the monks to their home to recite the sutra so that they can create marriage. So when I was still young, studying in Kopan Monastery, you know, one of my distant relatives, you know, requested me to come and recite that sutra. So that was one of the early sutra that I was introduced. And so in Tibet, this sutra is known as, you know, the sutra that closed the door to lower realms, commonly kind of known as the sutra that closed the door to the lower realms. And you will find as we go through the sutra, in sutra itself, the Buddha mentions, you know, when you recite, memorize, write it down, you know, share it through others, contemplate, study, contemplate. When you do that, you know, then by the power of doing that, you know, your negative karma will be purified. As a sign of being purified, in this very lifetime, you will experience one of obstacles. One of the obstacles in this very lifetime, but it's a good sign, it's not a bad sign. It's a sign of being purified. It's a sign that now you have purified of negative karma, otherwise that will have led you to lower rebirth, and by being experiencing some obstacle here, that karma has been completely purified, and therefore it closed the door to the Lord above. So that is well, kind of, within the Tibetans, is normal, and the sutra of closing the door to the Lord is known as that. So that is powerful, powerful reciting, you know, writing yourself or sponsoring to write and print, you know, memorizing, you know, studying, contemplating is a very powerful way to purify. And also is a very powerful way to accumulate merit, you know. And as I mentioned before, when we do the talk, you know, the merit is necessary for our spiritual progress. It is the positive energy or positive potential that supports the practice, the conducive condition that supports the practice. And it is a very powerful way to accumulate. And again, as if you read the suttas, it's mentioned again and again so many times as the benefit of reciting, you know, memorizing, studying, contemplating, you know, how much merit you create is something unimaginable beyond our Buddha. In sutra, he said, you know, if I have to mention every benefit, your mind will be crazy. Your mind will go crazy because we wouldn't be able to conceive it. We might feel, oh, is how can that be possible? You know, our mind cannot imagine. Our mind doesn't have capacity to do that. So he said he's only going to explain only some benefit of it. He is not going to explain every benefit of it because our mind doesn't have capacity to digest that and understand that. You know, and so again, as you go through that, you can see that, and so that is extremely powerful also for not only for purification and accumulation of merit, and both of them clearly mentioned in the sutta itself. And again, you know. When you recite such sutras, where they explain about the wisdom realizing emptiness directly, you know, where that has the capacity to destroy all the delusions and the very root of the delusion completely, of course, it has the potential to destroy the negative karma that is created. But on the basis of those delusions, you know, it has the power not only to cut and destroy the delusion, even the very root of all the delusions. And when he had this power to destroy that, then of course negative karma is much, you know, not as powerful as those delusions itself. And so therefore, that is how it is so powerful to. And then, you know, also this wisdom realizing emptiness, which is the main subject of this sutra, is also the main cause for all the enlightened beings to achieve enlightenment. As it is said in Heart Sutra, as it also here, all the Buddhas of three times manifest or achieve their enlightenment by relying on this wisdom, wisdom realizing the emptiness. And so therefore, you know, since that wisdom is the most, you know, powerful way to achieve that fully awakened state that you need so much merit, you know. And this sutras explains how to cultivate that wisdom and that wisdom path. And so therefore, you know, is again why it is so powerful to accumulate incredible merit, you know, unimaginable, beyond our grasp, our mind grasp. So, and from the title, is called Dhammakatha Sutra or Vasarakatha Sutras. You know, it is mentioned that diamond is, you know, among the precious gems, is the most valuable, most strongest. You know, it can destroy other gems, and people use the diamond to cut the other gems, stones and other things. It's so powerful. Where others cannot destroy, it destroyed that one. In the same way, the main subjects of this sutra, the main topic of this sutra, is the wisdom realizing emptiness and the emptiness itself. And that wisdom realizing emptiness is the one that can cut all the delusions. The delusion cannot overcome it. The delusion cannot harm that wisdom. Delusions are unable to harm or hurt that wisdom, but instead the wisdom can destroy and completely cut all of them. Therefore, it's like that diamond, inner diamond. You know, inner diamond that cuts all the delusions from the very root of it. So from the title itself, we know what subject it is and how powerful that is and why we need to develop that. I will do the oral transmissions tomorrow morning. And again, because this is sutra that all the FMD centers recite time to time as a group, individually. Probably there are people who also recite. And also it is one of the advice our guru, you know, late precious Kedi Lama Sopa Rinpoche advice to recite, especially during the holy special holy times or dates, and of course every day if we can, you know. And so, and since this is something that we recite, if we have the oral transmissions, then it's more beneficial, you know. Rinpoche once explains that one of his own teacher, Kiri Sensei Rinpoche, explains that if you have the oral transmissions, it becomes like equal by reciting 100 times when you recite one time. You know, one of that. Secondly, it is, you know, the orally pass unbroken lineage from the Buddha himself until now. Many of sutra do not have unbroken lineage anymore. There's no more oral transmissions. Some sutra have, some sutras have the oral transmissions, had direct oral transmission have been lost. So some of those sutra we cannot receive. And but there are many other sutras still where the oral transmission is still alive. And Dhammakatha Sutra is one of those sutras where the oral transmission is still unbroken and continues, and therefore, you know, if we have that, the practice becomes more powerful, more effective. Whatever, however we do, whether we recite it, whether we study it, whether we try to contemplate, meditate on that, meaning of that, you know, there are different way of using this sutra in our practice, you know. And whichever way you use it for recitations, for writing it, you know, for sharing it, for reflecting, contemplating on it, you know. But if you have the oral transmission, it is the blessing is passed. The direct blessing that has been passed orally, directly. And that cannot be, you cannot have that from the books or YouTube, you know, it has to come directly, you know, unbroken that way. So that so, and also, you know, Kabir Lama Sowa Rinpoche mentioned, as quoting from Kabir Chensha Rinpoche, you know, that when you are oral transmission, when you achieve the path of second path, the path of propagations, you know, then when you have this dharani or concentration or non-forgetting, at that time, then it said all this oral transmission that you have received will be, you know, remembered, and you know that. Yes. So there are many reasons and benefit why oral transmissions, to have oral transmissions, you know, and that's why, including His Holiness Dalai Lama, who is the most enlightened beings, at least in our lineage, in our times, even he paid so much attention to the oral transmissions. He have received many of those from different teachers. Not necessarily the other teachers are more enlightened than him. Not necessarily the other teacher had something to teach him that he doesn't know. But they have the oral transmission, he doesn't have the oral transmission. And because he wants to receive the oral transmissions, then he you know, rely on the teachers. In some cases, even ordinary monks, you know, where even some other lamas do not have that oral transmission, and only one ordinary monks have that oral transmission. And His Holiness feel that if he doesn't receive it and pass to others, nobody will receive from that monk, and that lineage will be no more there. The oral transmission will be lost. And because of that, then, you know, there are instances where he have taken those oral transmission from some even ordinary monks who have those lineage of the oral transmission. So that is, if someone like His Holiness the Lama, most enlightened at our time, you know, and who is very much, you know, use his reasoning and logic, doesn't just accept because someone says or because this says, you know, with that mind, he also feel the importance of that. You know, he understand the importance of that. Sometimes I think that is one factor. I think sometimes we don't pay attention. We feel like if I can study from the books or wherever, those oral transmissions are not so important. You know, because it's not only about knowledge, it's about realizations. if we don't have oral transmission, we still, by the, reading the books, and we can study from many other sources, and you can have the knowledge about that. But to turn that knowledge into experiential understanding, what were spiritual realizations, then those knowledge are not enough. No, you need more than that. And the blessings of such as the direct passing of unbroken lineage of the blessings play some role in that. So anyway, and I myself, you know, received from Lama Sopa Rinpoche a few times, you know. Yeah, I think maybe I can share the stories. I don't think it's not bad, I guess, or wrong. You know, in 2004, after 2.5 years in the US, I asked Rinpoche, you know, that I would like to do long retreat and to give the permissions. And Rinpoche gave permissions. And then, you know, Rinpoche gave me many advice and many practice to do, you know. And among many practices that he gave me to do, one of them was to recite Vastagata, Dhammakatha Sutra, you know, 10,000. So that, among many, many other practices, that was one of them, you know. Then, you know, as I mentioned, even though I have exposed when I was young, but I haven't recited or read it for quite a long time. And so then, you know, I recited and checked it, how much it took me, you know, to complete. At that time, it took me 45 minutes. Then I started to calculate, you know, how long it will take me, you know. Then it seems like even I recite 5 hours each day, you know, that it will take me 3 years. Just reciting 5 days every day, you know. And so, and when one time when Rinpoche was in Sera, you know, I happened to be there, I think for his own Dalai Lama's teaching, I guess. And so I sent a questions or requests or to Rinpoche through one of his attendants at that time, Jimba. Now Gishi Jimba. If you could ask Rinpoche, that Rinpoche gave me, among many of practice, one of those practice was those 10,000, and it seems it would take me 3 years just to do that. And so, can I sponsor? Can I do a little bit myself, and can I sponsor the monks and nuns to recite for me? With that, you can know what practitioner I am. So, you know, bargaining. We learn in India and Nepal bargaining everything. You have to bargain everywhere with the taxi, you have to bargain every shop. You know. So I guess I was bargaining also in the practice. And then the answer, you know, came was no, you have to do yourself. uh, Zimba explained me. Rinpoche was clapping and laughing, and then so there was no discount. then Rinpoche advised, no, that you should do yourself, but you don't have to think it as that you need to do that before you do the actual retreat. I simply mean, you know, Rinpoche said, you know, you can think of your lifetimes, you know, within the lifetime you can do it. It is not like something you have to do now before you start the retreat before that. So that put me a little bit kind of took away a little bit of burden, because I felt like, because that was Rinpoche giving me as preliminary, so I felt like I have to finish all this preliminary before I go to all the actual retreat. And that means, you know, with not including others, it seems like 2-3 years just doing that. And so then once I got that advice, you know, then I requested Rinpoche if he could give me the oral transmissions, you know, because if I'm going to recite so many times, you know, it would be beneficial to have oral transmissions. And then Rinpoche, you know, accepted very delightfully. Rinpoche was happy. And then, yeah, Rinpoche gave that the first time. And then I also received other times. And then once after that, and then I started doing that, you know. And, you know, I completed in 4 or 5 years, you know. And I found it was also sometimes I felt it was also one of Rinpoche's very skillful way of engaging you into practice, you know. Because I have all of that, you know. Whenever I was traveling, and when the plane get delayed, I feel excited. Oh, I can finish one, two, three, you know. Instead of feeling upset, or, you know, that feel like that you have this opportunity or time. It was very helpful in that way, you know. There's something. And then also when I was in Copan, you know, running the school, the educations. Sometimes when we have break, sometimes we have time, you know. Normally, you know, you chit chat with your friends and that, you know, when you have break. But when I have that, you know, I feel like I need to go and recite instead of chit chatting. So again, you know, it was helpful. From not wasting your time, it helped me in that way. And since then, you know, like after I finished the 10,000 as Rinpoche advice, I continue to do every day, took commitment, and I enjoy doing that. At the very beginning, I did it, not necessarily I enjoy doing it, because Rinpoche advised me to do it, you know. But with the time, I don't know, the blessing or something, I started really enjoying reciting that. I really started enjoying that very much. And because of that, you know, it became like my commitments. Of course, I don't have any commitment to do that, but I do every day. No matter how busy, no matter where I am. So I've been able to do that, you know, and feel good about it. So I think, again, you know, I think maybe there's some blessings, you know, that inspire me to continue to do it. and enjoy doing that. And as I was mentioning before, so there is a little bit kind of about the kind of the lineage and how it came about, how I received it. And as I was also mentioning before, that you know how this sutra is one of the most, I think between the Heart Sutra and Dhammakatha Sutra, the most two well-known sutras and practice in all the Mahayana traditions. When I was visiting some of the monasteries in Japan and Korea, you know, I saw not only in the monastery, also outside the monastery, the lay practitioners and reciting those with a fish, wooden fish knocking, you know, and they have very nice way of chanting. Oh, there, yeah, I see that, yeah. So with that, they are very, very nice way of chanting. When you listen to it, it inspires you, it's something, you know, some feelings arises. So I've seen them chanting that everywhere, you know. And if you see, there are so many translations of Dhammakatha Sutra in, you know, Korea, Japan, Chinese, you know, so many different translations by different translators, masters. So it is one of the most, well-known practice, sutra that has been continued to practice very strongly in all those Mahayanas, within all the Mahayana lineage and the countries. The main, as I mentioned at the very beginning, you know, the topic of the sutra is the path to enlightenment, you know. As the sutra, the Supiti asks to the Buddhas, you know, someone who is interested in the Bodhisattva's path, how should they practice? How should they enter the Bodhisattva path? And once you enter the path, how should you engage in the practice? And based on that, and that is the way the main theme or the main practice, then Buddha explained about that. And explaining about, you know, in order to enter the Bodhisattva path, engage, that one must cultivate the Bodhicitta mind, you know, the wish to liberate each and every sentient being without excluding anyone, but including each and every sentient beings, that wish to liberate them from the suffering and cause of suffering, and wish to lead them to a fully enlightened state, and for that, to the wish to achieve that fully awakened state yourself, to cultivate that Bodhicitta mind. And that is the cultivating that Bodhicitta mind is the way to enter the Bodhisattva path. Then to become Bodhisattva. And in order to develop the Bodhicitta mind, and then one need to develop the great compassions first. You know, without great compassion, there's no way to develop the Bodhicitta realizations. You know, I think at certain time in Tibet, you know, because again, you know, Buddhism came in Tibet around 7-8 centuries, and then it declined and became a little polluted, and then Adisha around 10th, 11th century came and revived to its purity, you know. And at that time, you know, there were certain, you know, people, practitioners who think the bodhicitta is that you, at the beginning of motivation, you try to feel, like we try to do, you know, generate the bodhicitta mind a little bit at the very beginning in the motivation, and they think that is the bodhicitta. If you have that, and you develop bodhicitta mind. And Adisha mentions, you know, you Tibetan know how to develop bodhicitta without great compassions. You know, there's no way for us in our traditions, in our lineage, to develop bodhicitta realization without the great compassions, you know. So he was being a little bit sarcastic in a way, you know, that mentioning of that. Basically, what he's saying, there's no bodhicitta realization without the great compassions. In order to develop the bodhicitta, you need to have great compassions. On the basis of great compassion, then one develops bodhicitta mind, you know. And at the very beginning, you know, that kind of the wish, driven by the great compassion, the wish to achieve that fully awakened state arises when you meditate, when you put effort. But when you don't meditate, when you don't put effort, it does not arise. But as one continues to practice, meditate more and more, then with the familiarity and with the training, it becomes more and more easier. It requires less and less effort. And it arises more often. And slowly, one is able to arise that feelings, the wish to achieve that fully awakened state in order to liberate all sentient beings from the suffering cause, arises effortlessly, naturally, day and night. When that happens, and that is what we call the realization of bodhicitta, you know, that is when you have this effortless, spontaneous, naturally, you know, day and night of that feelings, that bodhicitta, the aspiration, the wish to achieve fully awakened state, the Buddha would, in order to benefit all sentient beings, then that is what we call realization. And when you have that realization, then you become bodhisattva. Then you become true bodhisattva. You know, regardless of your gender, regardless of your whatever others, but you, whoever that being become bodhisattva, true bodhisattvas. And from that moment, you enter the first path of the bodhisattva, the path of accumulations. Then you enter the first path. So in the sutras, Buddha explained, to enter the bodhisattva path, then you need to develop this bodhicitta mind. But while you develop bodhicitta mind, you shouldn't be grasping to you that who want to achieve that fully enlightened state in order to liberate all sentient beings. Nor you should be grasping to the sentient beings that you are going to be liberated. Nor you should be grasping to the enlightenment that you want to achieve in order to liberate all sentient beings. You should train in not having grasping while you generate that bodhicitta mind, the wish to liberate all sentient beings. In order to liberate all sentient beings, the wish to achieve fully enlightened state, at the same time, training not to be any grasping to the self, grasping to the sentient beings that are going to benefit and to be liberated, to be benefited, nor to the enlightenment. If we have grasping to them, then attachment arises. attachment arises. With attachment, expectations arises. Fear arises. And suspicious arises. And then that give arise to also dislike, you know, aversion, anger. When you're attached to something, and when you feel someone might be obstacles, has been obstacle, could be obstacle, might be obstacle, then you started to have dislike, aversions, and anger towards that. You know? And thereby your practice does not become completed. Your practice become uncompleted. That lack of wisdom. Your practice is completed when the method, the compassion, the bodhicitta and wisdom come together. Just as you need the bird need the two wings to fly, we need the two wings of compassion and wisdom in order to fly to the shore of fully enlightened state, to achieve that fully enlightened state. And therefore, you know, and so the how can we not have, yeah. And when you have that grasping and attachment and expectation, then that become, that can become an obstacle in our practice and path. You know, when you have so much attachment to the outcome, the result, the more stronger attachment, the more stronger expectation you have about the outcome, about the result, the more stronger, you know, attachments you have, the more stronger expectations. The more stronger expectations, more likely to have more disappointment, discouragements. A lot of time, practitioner become very discouraged after some time. Why? Because they have too much expectation from the practice. They have too much expectation to have a big result, quick outcome, big outcome. And when that doesn't happen, then they become disappointed and discouraged, become obstacles in their path. And that kind of expectations and comes because we are so attached to that. Less attachments means less expectations. Less expectation, less disappointment. Less disappointment, less discouraged. In terms of result, in terms of same thing, you know, in terms of path, getting attached to the path itself, you know. So when you have no grasping to the path itself, the result itself, then there is less expectations. Less expectations, then, you know, there's less disappointment. And doesn't become obstacles. Otherwise, it can become obstacles in your path. It become obstacle for a lot of practitioners because they become, you know, disappointed, discouraged, and the illusions, you know. And then they completely give up practice. they completely give up their practice, their God. Or their practice is not strong anymore as they it used to be, because there's no strong inspiration and confidence, you know. And so therefore, that's here, not to have grasping. How can we let go of grasping? By understanding the selflessness of the yourself, the emptiness of the self, by seeing the emptiness of the sentient beings, which are the object to be liberated, object to be benefited, and as well as emptiness of the result, the enlightenment that need to be achieved, you know. So by understanding the emptiness of all of them, you know, then you don't have any grasping to all of them. And we don't have grasping, then, you know, attachments, anger do not arise on the basis of that grasping, the ignorance, the grasping. And yeah. So that is in the sutta, that is what Buddha explained, you know, start how to those who are interested in the Bodhisattva path, they should first try to develop that Bodhisattva mind without that kind of grasping. And then he explained, once you have entered the path, how to engage in the Bodhisattva path, how one should engage in the Bodhisattva path once you have entered the path through the practice of six perfections or 10 perfections. Of course, in the sutra, Buddha explicitly touched on the first perfections, but it referred to all the 10 perfections. Normally, six perfections, and when we relate with the 10 bhumis, then the 10 perfections, you know, or paramitas, you know, six paramita, 10 paramita, the paramita of generosity, paramita of moral discipline, the paramita of patience, the paramita of joyous effort in virtues, the paramita of mental concentration, wisdom, those are the six. And in term of 10, then, you know, in the paramita of method, the paramita of power, the paramita of prayer, the paramita of exalted wisdom. So then when you add those four, then it becomes 10 paramita. And especially when you talk about the 10 bhumis, each of those bhumis has, even though they practice all 10 paramita, each of them have more specific focus on one parameter. And so that is how also is related to those 10 parameters in that. So again, while we engage in that path, the path of six parameter, 10 parameter, once you have entered the Bodhisattva path, then you try to engage and practice in those 6-10 parameters. While you try to practice, such as the six parameter, 10 parameter, again, you try to practice those practices, those parameter without grasping. When you practice generosity, not grasping to yourself, who is practicing generosity, not grasping to the objects of the generosity, whatever object, whether it's external material objects or non-material objects, such as Dharma practice or others, you know, not being grasping, not grasping the self who is practicing the generosity, not grasping the object itself, and not grasping to whom you are giving, practicing the generosity. Again, same things. If you have grasping, then again attachment arises. With attachments, again, expectations arises. With expectations, again, you know, disappointment, and not only disappointment, sometimes that can lead to resentment and anger as well. And sometimes we find you practice generosity, you know, but you are attached to certain outcome from your practice of generosity, you know. There come the expectations. You want certain outcome from your contributions, from your generosity. And when that outcome is not there, something else, or not being able to actualize, then you get disappointment. Not only disappointment, sometimes you get resentment, angry. You know, I shouldn't have contributed. You know, my contribution has been wasted. You know, you feel bad about your practice of generosity, which something good, that you did something good. Now you regret it. You feel bad about it instead of feeling good about it. And not only that, then you get upset with the people to whom, who are kind of in charge of that project or whatever. Upset and angry. Resentment, all this arises. Why? Because there were certain expectations for our contributions, for our generosity. And that expectation was not met. And that kind of expectation come because of, again, attached to certain outcome. And that comes because of the grasping. So again, and also, so therefore, again, when you practice such as generosity, any other paramita in the sutra, it explains you should practice without any grasping. And the way to practice without any grasping is by understanding, reflecting the emptiness of the self, emptiness of the object of generosity, the emptiness of the emptiness to whom you are giving, the emptiness of outcome, the result, you know. So when we are able to practice without grasping, by understanding the emptiness, then also your practice become complete, both method and wisdom complete. Otherwise it becomes incomplete. Again, it becomes complete practice, and it becomes much more powerful. The practice becomes much more powerful, much more effective than if it's not complete. So you know, and then through the engaging, by engaging the practice of 6-10 paramita, then you know, one achieve the result of two kayas, two bodies, the Buddhas, you know, Rupakaya, Dhammakaya, and Rupakaya. The two kayas or the two bodies, the form body and wisdom body. That is by engaging in those 6-10 paramita, then one achieve that fully awakened state. By achieving that two kayas, you know. But even when you achieve two kayas, again, here it says, you know, you shouldn't get attached. You shouldn't have any grasping to the two kayas, even the result. The Rupakaya with a major or minor signs, and Dharmakaya. The wisdom Dharmakaya, one shouldn't have any grasping to that. If you have a grasping, again, the practice is incomplete. Again, you have all these others, afflictive emotion arising. Again, more attachments, more expectation, disappointment, all of that. So therefore, you know, one even for that, you know, then again, if you learn to achieve it without any clinging, grasping, and one engage in that practice by understanding the emptiness of a rubak, the form body, by understanding the emptiness of the wisdom dharmakaya as well, by understanding the emptiness of both body or kayas. Through that, and that you achieve enlightenment. That is all. So that is the main theme of the sutra. You know, main theme of the sutras. And sometimes it might feel like it's repeating again and again, you know, but again, it is explaining the progress from first path to second path, third path, fifth path, you know. And just like in Heart Sutras, you know, it seems like it's repeating again and again, but again, with these different stages, is explaining how we progress by engaging a profound wisdom path, how we progress from one path to the next path. And when you progress from one path to the next path, the practice are very similar. It's just that your wisdom gets more stronger and stronger, and you accumulate more and more merit, your wisdom gets more stronger, more sharp, more profound, and through that, and with that more powerful, more sharp, more profound wisdom, then you are able to destroy from subtle to growth to subtle to more subtle level of those eclectic emotions. And through that, from dualistic to less dualistic to non-dualistic, in that way, that is how we make progress, one from one path to another. So, but the basic practice is very similar. It's not like each path you have different meditation emptiness. It's the same. And so therefore, even though we seem like that, it's a repeating, but it's a repeating because it's explaining, you know, how from one path to next path, how it improves when you progress and improve, then you continue to practice in that way, you know, very similar in that way. So, yeah, so I think that is the more theme. And then at the end, you know, with a different example, like a star, karma, you know, like this, a karma, mirage, and so forth, you know, then it kind of summarize the essence of those teachings, this sutra, you know, the emptiness, the profound path of the wisdom, realizing the emptiness. So I think that is a little bit kind of introductions to the sutra and the content of the sutra, the topic of sutra. So if there's caution, I can take one or two cautions, if there is any cautions.
I've actually got a question right at the very beginning when you mentioned about obstacles, and I must admit I kind of got a little worried about that for a moment, like, uh-oh, what obstacles do I have to look forward to? But say when you're at the airport and there's a delay and then you see there's beneficial to be able to recite, so does that mean that the obstacle of the delay is no longer an obstacle? Or is it both an obstacle? Is it a good thing and a bad thing? Or how do you look at it?
Well, the delay didn't get because I started reciting. So it wasn't the obstacles manifesting as a part of that. I mean, it could be from maybe my recitation this morning or that morning or evening. It's hard to know whether that particular, for us, it's hard to know specifically, very particular, what I'm experiencing is a result of which karma, you know. It's a result of this, that karma is, unless you achieve certain high realizations. You know, that is why they say a specific karma, you know, which we can predict this karma will manifest at this time, in this life, in this way, to be able to predict that, or to be able to see this karma as a result of that particular karma in that lifetime, this person. that is something that unless you have high realizations, even sometimes the arhat, they can, even they have some limitation in seeing how far they can see that. They can see for certain distance, but sometimes they cannot see the most far, like the Buddha himself, because they still have some obscurations. You know? And so therefore for us, it will be very difficult to see, to know for sure, but whatever obstacle happens, we try to think it is a good sign, it's a sign of purifications, instead of seeing it's a bad sign. Instead of seeing it's a, you know, seeing as a manifestation of negative karma, which seems to have negative bad, you see it's a manifestation of purifications, which connotes something positive. And we look forward for that, something good. And so, so regardless whether that was the exactly actually of being purified of that or not, even we are not sure, but to be able to see that can be helpful, just like any other lojong practice, you know.
We have a question from Inke, who's online, please. And she asks, how do we know the difference between grasping and aspiration?
Mm-hmm. Aspirations is not so uptight. Grasping has much more uptight, you know, very, you can have inspiration, but with very relaxed, you know, nothing so uptight about that. But when it's a grasping, there's sense of uptightness in that, you know, in that, that is one different, you know, factors. With the graspings, you know, then it can lead to other negative emotions, disturbing, it can give rise, it will give rise to other negative emotions. With aspirations, it doesn't give arise to negative emotions, but instead it gives rise to other positive emotions, positive feeling that aspirations can lead you to, you know, something more positive state of mind, not a negative state of mind. So those are some, you know, And also when you think about specific grasping, like ignorance, you know, then there is sense of, in that grasping mind, there's sense of belief that there is something, the object is something very solid, inherent, you know. Whereas inspiration doesn't have that sense, doesn't need to have that, doesn't have that, you know, that believing, that mind, the inspiration mind, believing that object is inherent, solid existence, you know. So those are the some differences.
Practicing signlessness, wishlessness, and emptiness is non-activity. And non-activity is the path to liberation.
Yes. when you talk about signless, wishless, and emptiness, we are talking about actually emptiness. You know, emptiness of the nature of the objects, you know, the cause and the result. The wishless is about the emptiness of the result. You know, signless is about the emptiness of the cause. So by seeing the object itself, nature of the object itself, as well as the cause of that object, as a result of those objects, all emptiness is the way to liberations. And also when you say non-activities, again, we have to refer same things, you know, non-truly existing activities, you know, or non-mental activities of the superstitious mind. You know, Sometimes we call Midopa, you know, without conception, without thoughtless, but which means there's no activities in your mind. And when you say there's no activity in your mind, or thoughtless, or without conception, we are not saying totally non-concept, but that is talking about this thought of this grasping, you know. Okay.
Thank you so much, Keshawan.
Thank you. Good night. Thank you. Good night.